everybody, and welcome to this per capita webinar about the latest quarterly essay, Bad Cop, Peter Dutton's Strongman Politics. I'm delighted to be joined by Lek Blaine, the author, here today. I'd like to start by acknowledging that I'm coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong people of the Kulin Nation and the Wurundjeri people, Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. Thank them for their custodianship over many generations, many thousands of years of the lands and waters on which we meet today, and pay my respects to the elders and First Nations people of wherever you might be joining us from. I'm assuming everyone can hear me. I'd like to emphasise that we are recording the session today. If you have a question at the end of our chat, initial chat that you would like to put to Lek, please post it in the Q&A. I can see some of you have done that already, so we're certainly going to have a lively conversation about what is a really engaging and very readable essay with a fantastic turn of phrase, as usual, from our author here today about Peter Dutton, the leader now of the opposition and the alternative Prime Minister of our country. So, Lek, thanks so much for being with us.
No worries at all. Thanks for having me, Emma. It's great to be back and having a chat.
Yeah. Yes, it's good to have you back. So I'm going to just open by saying you've painted a really detailed and I think important picture of Peter Dutton here in this essay with your usual very engaging turn of phrase. You describe him early on in the essay. This struck me on first reading as someone who is always displaying simplicity and strength because he feels so complicated and weak. Can you give us a bit of an appraisal of the man from that jumping off point?
Look, that was a part of the essay where I didn't get to sit down and psychoanalyze Peter Dutton in terms of in person, and I didn't get access to him. Yeah, there's a certain leap that I'm making based upon his actions, based upon his words, based upon his history, and also based upon my, understanding of psychology and masculinity and, being someone who has came from the places that I've come from and has had certain experiences, in extreme experiences. So, I mean, I'm drawing from all of that and drawing from also Dutton's suggestions that he is potentially suffers from undiagnosed PTSD. So I'm not completely drawing too long of a bow, I don't think. And I think, there's certainly a tradition of with a lot of strongman leaders that often what seems like invulnerability publicly can often be based on a deep insecurities privately.
Mm. Maybe we should, just for the benefit of our audience that may not know you as well, go a little bit into your background. I mean, one of the great things about the choice of you to write this profile is your background, your personal background and understanding of Queensland, of its class politics, of its regional and regional issues. Can you go into that a little bit just to give people a picture of where you're coming from?
Yeah, so I was born in Kingaroy, which is where Joe Bjorke-Peterson, who was a character in the essay, like not a major character, but he makes an appearance, that he was from a farm near there. I lived in a nearby little town called Wandai for the first 4 years of my life, and my parents were publicans and foster carers, and then I grew up in Toowoomba, which is kind of like on the Darling Downs, is a kind of conservative hotbed within Australia, and moved to Brisbane when I was 18. I also lived in Bundaberg for a few years in my 20s. Queensland's a very big place, even Bundaberg, which is 6 hours north of Toowoomba. It's still not even close to the centre of Queensland because it just keeps on going and going. But, my dad's side of the family are all from Ipswich, so I had a lot of growing up, I was kind of like immersed in the local politics and kind of culture of Ipswich, which is a place that was the canary in the coal mine in terms of, for in Australian politics, in terms of the disconnection between Labor and their traditional working class base, and it was a seat the seat of Oxley, which was a very safe Labor seat, which was lost to Pauline Hanson in 1996. And Pauline Hanson had been married to her ex-husband was one of my dad's best mates, and so my dad and his mates have been vilified subsequently by Pauline Hanson as a major contributing factor to their eventual divorce because of the rugby league and heavy drinking and late night. So my uncle George, who was a black sheep of a big Ipswich working class family, did really well in house painting and actually ran for the Liberal Party in 1993 in the seat of Oxley, and was then knocked off for pre-selection before 1996 by Pauline Hanson. In a weird way, the Blaine family are potentially personally responsible for the creation of Pauline Hanson as a political force.
We won't hold you responsible for
that. And so, like, that's a little bit facetious, but I think it's interesting because even before I was actively, and I was named after Lech Walesa, who was a famous Polish politician and the leader of the Solidarity movement over there. So I was even before I was, you know, really fully knew what was going on, I was always like interested in politics and paying attention to politics, and I was aware of like the different characters and kind of tropes, and that has definitely contributed to the way that I analyse Australian politics now.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, without wanting to embarrass you too much, it's what makes you such a valuable voice today, because we don't have enough analysts, political analysts, commentators, people that look at our political system that come from a working class background, let alone a working class regional Queensland background or outer suburban Queensland background. And as you point out in the essay, I think throughout this essay, and I will, if you haven't read it yet, it's a great read. QE seems to be going from strength to strength these days. But what you do so cleverly is weave through Dutton's story the kind of history of the political shifts in Queensland, that left, right, pull, the class. I think what comes through really strongly is there's actually, you know, a very strong class element to politics in Queensland that many other writers are either unable or unwilling to address. Is that something you feel consciously determined to bring out, or is it just a natural?
Yeah. And I think I don't in the essay directly connect anything to my previous quarterly essay, Top Blokes. And Top Blokes analysed the persona of Scott Morrison, but it also analysed the disconnect between Labor and their traditional working class base. And I did that like it was, you know, it coming from a family that, like, you know, my parents were members of a local Labor Party branch, and they were kind of like old school Labor. So I didn't want to kind of, I definitely critiqued, I wanted to, at the same time as I was critiquing Scott Morrison, I wanted to critique the Labor Party and critique not just the Labor Party but also progressive political circles in Australia, because there is like a disconnect and there is sometimes a misunderstanding about what is driving people to vote against seemingly their economic interests. And and sometimes that can be done, that often gets done, but then sometimes that can be done in quite a patronising way, in the sense that it's like, well, these people are idiots. But then a lot of the time when you talk to voters and pick up their stories, and there's actually quite often rational reasons behind the way that they think or vote the way they do, even if they're not like heavily engaged in the political process, there's like a kernel of like reality in what they think. And so I think that as the Labor Party have made a less overtly pronounced attempt to connect with the class politics of Australia, that has opened room for the Liberal Party to do that in a way that it is kind of like aesthetic, like it doesn't really bear much scrutiny in terms of their economic policies. But the reason why that can be seductive is because a lot of voters feel like there is no tangible economic difference between the parties. And so if they are being asked, if they don't sense a tangible economic difference between the parties, then it's easier for them to go, well, which party do I associate more with on those cultural issues, all the cultural war issues? And a lot of these people associate more with the Liberal Party on cultural issues. Not everyone, but in terms of you know, working class people in, it's not just Queensland, but in regional areas and outer suburban areas, if they are asked to just vote based upon culture, a lot of them will vote for the Liberal Party or for conservatives, because a lot of them are quite, you know, socially conservative. And that goes for like some of the most ethnically diverse electorates in Australia, that they are quite socially conservative. And so what you, the only way that you can get past the cultural differences between inner city progressives, university educated progressives, and kind of like moderately socially conservative but quite economically progressive outer suburban and regional voters is through economics. Economics is the only thing that kind of transcends all those differences. And so, I don't think that Labor is like completely oblivious to that, but it is quite a difficult balancing act. And the ALP isn't personally responsible for the disengagement between working class people and progressive political parties. This is a thing that's happened right throughout the world. And if anything, the ALP has actually been reasonably successful at stemming the flood. Like they haven't, they do a lot better with working class communities than what a lot of European social democratic parties have done, and they've pretty much evaporated. So it's not, I think that's partly because of, I think the union influence in some ways has been quite positive in that sense, like in terms of creating a direct link. But yeah, that's getting a little bit off topic, Dutton. But I think that that's important to kind of like emphasize, because I think Dutton, whether some of his aims are quite ambitious, and you know, you can debate whether he's, you know, talking out of his ass or not, but there is like something, he is identifying something that exists and that is real, and that there is like a vulnerability there for Labor.
Yeah, I think you're right. And well, you know, I think you're right. We had this a similar conversation when you published Top Blokes, but that our inability to talk, or our refusal, certainly the media's refusal to talk about class in economic terms and to see class through a cultural lens, makes that conversation much more hidden in Australia than it is in other parts of the world, I think.
Yeah, and one of the things that shines through, I think, in top in Bad Cop is the way that the people who are talking most about class in modern Australia seems to be conservatives. Like Peter Dutton, you know, he's like calling the coalition the parties of Australia's working class. Like you know, and as I said, you can debate the reality or not of that, but like there's lots of examples where conservative politicians are actually speaking more about class than progressive ones. And but then, you know, there's other examples of maybe I think progressives are starting to become awake to those really tangible class differences. And if they can prosecute that, then we can get to this point where there is like a more tangible tangible debate in Australia for people who might be a little bit disengaged to actually go, well, this is actually about my life, and this is actually real. This is not just kind of culture war bulldust.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as well as your socioeconomic, family, cultural background, the fact that this essay and this analysis is being written by someone of your age and generation is really important, because what hits me, I lived through these years. You know, the election of Pauline Hanson was probably the thing that really motivated me to engage more with electoral politics. The shock that someone like that could say the things she could say in 1996 when I was in my early 20s, after what had been, you know, a bipartisan commitment, other than John Howard's attempts to undermine it, to multiculturalism, to a cosmopolitan, outward-looking, you know, nation that was finding its feet in our region. That was a big shock for a lot of young people when that happened. But to me, it's not such ancient history. You know, it's the trajectory of my engagement with politics. Whereas what one thing you said somewhere in the essay, that you see Dutton as a man that's constantly harking back to what he sees as his time when he entered politics in the late 90s, early 2000s, a time when it was strongman politics, it was fear of the other, it was, you know, the battlers in the suburbs making good bank off the recently liberated housing policy reforms.
Yeah.
And I think you at the end say that something like John Howard turned the Australian dream into a Ponzi scheme or pyramid scheme, and Dutton's now in a business of running a protection racket for the winners, of whom he was one.
Yeah.
from your perspective, looking back at that time, that's been your life effectively, your through childhood and young adulthood. Can you talk a bit about, because you weave that trajectory through the essay really well as well. There's a lot in there about how Australia has shifted and how we're now, you know, in a country where he is running a protection racket for the people that did very well. Do you see your generation as becoming more alive to the economics of class because of that shift?
I think definitely if you look at the recent, even since the election, like the debate around housing is hitting critical mass, and it's not just kind of like highly engaged progressive young people who are engaging in it, but it's kind of like I think a real awakening across the board, including amongst people who might have traditionally been liberal voters on cultural issues, but also kind of like the old, you know, what are now the teal seats, where voters whose parents would have been rusted on liberal voters, and their kids are they might be earning really good money and they went to university, but they're becoming awake to those economic differences that the previous generations of in their family wouldn't have been awake to. And so that's kind of like, I think, going to just send, and it might not happen overnight, but it's going, because this is a difficult thing for mainstream political parties in Australia. Like, partly there might be just some apathy, partly there's self-interest, but then there is also the electoral realities of the majority of people, adults in Australia, own a property. So anyone who comes out and says that we're going to do anything that is going to, like, nobody, like, so some of the people voting in self-interest, they actually aren't property investors. They don't have rental properties, but they do want their property. They've been told for 30 years that the key to their retirement and the key to the economic security of their children is for their house to continually go up in price. Yeah. So that it's not pure greed or selfishness for them to be, be skeptical about policies that will mess with that, because that's become like a really deeply ingrained kind of cultural value in Australia. Yeah. And that's been playing out, as I said, for it'll soon be probably like 3 decades. That's been like the, and even before that, there was like a deeply ingrained idea about the Australian dream. It's just that the Australian dream was taken and then made into this whole other
pyramid scheme. But,
and so in terms of like the way that Dutton fits into that, I think that he is someone who didn't come from like the poorest background, but he didn't come from like a kind of elite either. So he learned through experience that for someone who, by his own admission, wasn't like academically gifted, struggled at university, joined the police force, started buying properties with his dad, who was a bricklayer, became a builder, and kind of learned that that then leaves the police force, goes full time into property development at exactly the same time that John Howard is introducing changes that will spark like boom that continues now. So he's got like a really deep emotional loyalty, I think, to that that system. And he feels offended in some ways, the suggestion, like a lot of other issues where he's offended about the elites, where he kind of, I think, would feel offended that people think that it's less noble to have made his money in property than, say, some of Malcolm Turnbull's investments as a merchant banker. Like, because he's not, he's not a guy who's worth $100 million or $200 million, but he's done really well out of it. And so, I think that he in particular, and this goes for like some of the differences between him and like, say, Abbott, in that I think Abbott's reactionary conservatism, that was about a place in, that was about the going back to a place in Australia that was more like the 1950s Australia. Dutton's reactionary politics is a much more recent. It's like about preserving this period of time in the early 2000s, which is when he emerged from the trauma that he'd suffered as a police officer, went into politics at the age of 30, during probably the most defining election of the past decades in terms of 2001 and the way that it continues to reverberate throughout Australian politics. And then so he's like emotionally, and it's not just about, his personal trauma or whatever. It's about he's been taught through experience that's what wins elections. And it was this massive triumph for him. It's like proved that this guy who had a bit of a chip on his shoulder about the more highly educated that he could, that he can beat them, that he can win, and he can, and he rose really quickly through the ranks of the Liberal Party, like under someone, one of the canniest politicians in Australian history, and John Howard. So John Howard wasn't just doing it through sympathy. He like he identified something about Peter Dutton that made him like a effective politician. It might not be the most articulate, might not be the most inspiring, but Howard saw something very effective within Peter Dutton.
And I think what you've demonstrated in your essay is that really Dutton, of anyone in the parliament, is actually the poster boy for Howardism. He benefited from those, you know, he personally benefited from the conservative years in Queensland, but then, as you point out, failed at university, became a policeman, had to leave the force because of personal trauma. His dad was a bricky who became a builder. He's the epitome of the guy that, you know, was nothing special, didn't feel like anything special, but was determined to be something special, and therefore was able to leverage those changes, those policies put in place by Howard that allowed your average, I mean, Howard used to talk about the cop and the teacher, right, who bought an investment property and built.
And some Telstra shares.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And he sees his nostalgia, as you point out, is for that time, that sort of turn of the century time when Australia felt incredibly relaxed and comfortable, in Howard's old terminology, failing perhaps to recognise that most of the prosperity had been set up by the hard work of previous generations, right back to the Second World War. But we rode that mining boom, we rode those tax concessions in order for people, a specific group of people, to build quite a lot of wealth. And what Howard did so cleverly, we talked about this in Top Blokes too, was take those traditionally Labor voting people in lower middle class and working class Australia, tradies, cops, teachers, and gave them what Menzies had done on steroids. Menzies created a nation of little capitalists by allowing people to buy their homes. Howard created a nation of untouchable middle class capitalists by allowing ordinary income earners to become investors and proper and landlords and self-employed business people rather than employed tradespeople. So I guess what struck me, and I just want to get your reflection on this, I think what you've hit on in the essay is so many people in the political class, the chattering classes, as Dutton himself might call them, have dismissed Dutton as unelectable. As you say, John Howard and Tony Abbott were seen as unelectable at one point too. But in some ways, he is the very epitome of that swinging voter that has decided elections in this country for 30 years, and that it is appealed to by what highly educated people go, well, that's bad, that's not their economic self-interest, but they actually feel, well, it is, you know, I might be over-leveraged, but I'm in control.
Yeah, and so, and I think that that's another point that I make in the essay is that Howard's pyramid scheme, you know, there, a lot of people missed out on it, like at the time, but there were a lot of working class, lower middle class people who, because they bought property and they didn't necessarily need to be own five or six properties, but because they bought property at the right time, they were able to, and they, you know, like say my parents, for example, who had no superannuation, no shares, but bought a house like just before that time and watched it kind of like go berserk. Like that there are all these people who actually had no, especially if they hadn't worked in a, you know, done a degree and worked in somewhere where you were getting superannuation, a lot of small business people, tradies, who did really well out of it. The problem is that you can't do that trick, like that it was so effective that you can't do that trick again. So now you've got a new generation of people for whom there isn't the possibility of social mobility in the way that there was for that previous generation. And so that's where there's like a, you know, Dutton is tapping into something real in terms of protecting that, because there's a lot of people that want to preserve that system. But then there's a lot of people who would be quite attracted to, you know, on the flip side, what we were talking about before, like in terms of Labor voters who are socially conservative. There's a lot of Liberal voters who might be social conservatives who are starting to look around and go like, well, we can't afford a house. And that's one of the main issues that can cut through political disengagement, because people know if a roof above their head, and whether they don't believe they can buy a house, or they can't afford to pay the rent, or they can't afford to pay their mortgage, that is one of the things that can cut through all of the disillusionment around politics. Like it's kind of like it's lived on a daily basis. And if people were feeling that kind of like existential stress, well, then you know it can make them susceptible to politicians who do run on fear and loathing, but it can also make them quite cynical about those campaigns as well. It can make them more awake to what politicians have actually been doing for the past 30 years in a way, similarly to a way that like COVID, I think, was a disaster for Scott Morrison, because a lot of people who might not necessarily pay all that much attention to politics were paying hyper focused on Scott Morrison every day because they were at home. And so it meant that his persona and public publicity PR stunts stopped working because people were like, it didn't measure up with their lived experience. And so I think that's kind of like happening with property now, and with a sense, especially for, you know, millennials and under, that the standard of living enjoyed by people's parents isn't going to be enjoyed by the next generation. There will be exceptions to that, like with anything. So I'm not saying that, you know, that it's not possible at all to have social mobility in modern Australia, but I think it's just less possible than what it was 30 or 40 years ago.
A lot harder than it was. I think most of our work at Per Capita is focused on this issue, you know, that in the years after the Second World War in particular, Australia was seen as the best place to live because of the opportunity that was afforded to anyone. If you work hard enough, you can build a really good middle-class life in this country, regardless of your background. We have pretty much destroyed all of taken out all of the rungs on that ladder of social mobility over the last 30 years or so. And that's certainly being felt really strongly in the electorate now. There's a couple more areas I want to cover before I go to the questions that are pouring into you from our audience. I think if you look at that, it's interesting to me that the state in which, and bearing in mind that the so-called teal independents didn't really run in Queensland, but the state in which the Greens were successful was in Queensland, in those three Brisbane seats, two formerly Liberal, one Labor, primarily on the issue of housing was what they ran on housing affordability. And so it is starting to, I think, take hold as a real example of an economic class imbalance. It's primarily being seen as a generational one, but of course, underpinning all of that is class, that we haven't seen in a long time. And as you point out in your essay, Dutton's riding the rhetoric of that, but his actual policy beliefs fly in the face of doing anything about housing affordability. He is, as you say, almost, you know, there's an emotional attachment for him because property investment's how he made his fortune. And so what's your view on, you know, what's likely to happen with that issue in Queensland, given it did shift quite a lot of votes at the last election, particularly in Queensland?
Yeah, and I think that the other thing that the Greens did before the last election in Queensland was there was lots of talk about the heavily local campaigns and the door knocking and that sort of thing, grassroots politics. And it was also just the simplicity of their messaging around like free mental and dental and mental. Like they were saying, you know, we're going to add dental and mental to Medicare. And so that's another example of like, Labor and government might say, well, that's impossible and how would we ever fund that at this stage? And, you know, that's a great aspiration. But it is like it's kind of like those kind of issues that cut through the cultural differences that people might have with the Greens. And they go, like, there were so many people they were like kind of inner city seats, but inner city Brisbane is different to inner city Sydney and Melbourne. So there were people who were voting for the Greens that weren't remotely, you know, social progressives in the mold of what you imagine the Greens voters in the southern states are. Like you're talking like people that I interviewed, like, sorry, my light has just gone off. I don't know why that happened. Yeah. So try to get this light. Oh, there we go.
There you go. You move.
Yeah. I was talking to people who'd voted for, who were loyal Howard voters who'd voted Hanson in the Senate before, like agricultural business executives who, and then they were voting for the Greens because they were saying, well, our kids can't afford to buy a house and we're annoyed. And it taps into this kind of, like, it's a kind of distinctly Queensland thing, and it's associated with Queensland, this sense that you just want to kind of like, I think someone from Queensland described it to me as like the fuck shit up mentality, where it's like, we're just so pissed off about stuff, and we just got like, we don't 100% agree with the Greens, but they're the most likely option besides the two major parties that can win seats, and kind of like fuck shit up. So like, if you let people get to that point, they're not voting, you know, they're not signing up wholesale for every single policy of the Greens. It's kind of like a it's about sending a message to the major parties. And that happened, you know, with, there's examples of that obviously happening with the Teal independents over, especially the last election, but that built up for quite a while. And then also a candidate like Dai Li and Fowler. And so I think that both parties are really vulnerable to independents. And like, I think the Labor Party will be increasingly vulnerable to economically progressive and socially conservative independents in the style of Dai Li. Like, I think that that's going to be the next battleground in this shift towards minor parties and independents.
Yeah, I think, in particular, as you said earlier, a lot of those traditionally Labor outer suburban seats with high first generation migrant populations. I mean, they're the ones that voted against marriage equality. So that the demographic changes are not easily categorized in right and left anymore. And we're seeing, you know, those cultural versus economic values bleeding across class lines. It's going to be a fascinating election. One more issue before we move on to the many questions. I remind people, if you want me to ask a question, please put them in the Q&A function. I can see a couple of Janets in the chat, so I'll keep an eye on those too. You conclude the essay, obviously comes right up to date, writing it right until the last minute, given the developments you've covered. But one issue that we were very exercised about for a long time at Per Capita was the stage three tax cuts. You bring them in towards the end, I think, as a really strong example of the kind of politics that we need more of, where you say that, you know, the best weapon against right-wing culture wars is actual real social democracy, and what the government ended up doing finally, after years of being scared of its own shadow on this, was reform the tax cuts in a way that were much more in line with social democratic thinking. Still, obviously, because of progressive taxation, much more benefit the more tax you pay. But you point out in your essay, I think, that shift, and it was one of the only real bold policy arguments we've seen the government take on and win in recent months, but it completely discombobulated Dutton. He didn't really know where to go with that at all, because what he was grappling with there was actually a policy that did do the things he said he wanted to do for working people, but he couldn't really, he was railing against it for that reason.
Yeah, and I think it's funny because it's like the Dutton is front and centre in so many kinds of emotive issues, but usually he's so devoid of any emotion at all, and his voice doesn't really go up. He's so practiced, and the one time that I've seen him like quite flustered, and it was like subtle, but like his voice was just slightly higher, and he just seemed flustered. What was the stage three tax cuts? And I think that was partly because, and he spoke openly about the fact that that Albanese was wedging him, and it was like he was getting a taste of his own medicine, and he was actually, and it's weird when you hear politicians talk publicly about the strategy involved in those decisions. And he was saying, well, this is a really smart political decision from a really smart political operator. Albanese knows what he's doing. He's wedging me, and, you know, like, he's not going to get away with it, sort of thing. Like, you don't sort of, it was weird for him to even delve into that. Like, it's like he's so used to wedge politics suiting conservative parties that he got really flustered about the fact that he'd been wedged in a similar way on an economic issue, which, I don't think that the stage three tax cut decision is going to single-handedly save the Labor Party's, like, the disillusionment with some voters towards the Labor Party. It kind of just stemmed the bleeding and changed the conversation and actually put it back into a debate that was based on tangible things rather than kind of like theoretical debates or social debates. And that was an example of where Dutton showed that he doesn't thrive in that situation. He had an opportunity to have a debate around tax reform, around inflation. And I know one operative said to me that former Labor operative said to me that the one most effective way to deal with Dutton isn't actually to engage with him on a lot of the social debates, but just constantly get him in a debate around inflation. And he doesn't thrive in economic debates. And so he had an opportunity to do that and just like absolutely squibbed it and went straight back to talking about The Voice, to talking about Australia Day. And like he's really that's I think, you know, he's very loyal to John Howard. John Howard admires him. It's been a mutually beneficial relationship for a long period of time. But Dutton doesn't have the same capacity as John Howard for actually engaging in sustained debate. And love him or loathe him, Howard was incredibly smart, and he was cunning, and everyone sort of talks about how cunning he was, but he was also quite creative. He was quite creative economically, but he was also quite creative electorally. He could he really had to synthesize so many different things around a changing country and a changing population and language, and then put it in a way that brought together his vision for what he wanted the Australian economy to be. I don't see the same Dutton having the same capacity as that. So I think
see that by now if it were there.
Yeah, exactly. So the more you draw him into those tangible economic debates, I think the better for the Labor Party. And so, and as frustrating as that might be for some progressives in terms of like not kind of taking the bait that Dutton, because Dutton's is constantly, what he's doing is constantly setting the bait for Labor and trying to wedge Labor between their socially progressive inner city base and their working class outer suburban and regional voters. And the harder that he can do that, and if he splits those voters, then the harder he goes and the harder that Labor takes the bait, like the more that those two groups split. So as I said earlier, like the only way to continue consistently be able to kind of transcend those divides is by focusing on economic issues that unite voters who might have very different social views and backgrounds.
And I think the real lesson that you identify in this essay is when you say Dutton needs to be tested, not placated. And there's been too much, I think. If you look back at John Howard struggled with this throughout the 80s. You know, he was not good at anything that we just said he was good at. It was only after his election win in 96, which, you know, was what, Lazarus with a triple bypass and a very demoralised and scattered and divided opposition then, for, you know, particularly after the 1998 loss, that Howard really came into his own. You don't see that trajectory with Dutton. He's limited. We've seen the limits of his capacity. So I think, you know, if I want anyone watching this and anyone in the Labor Party that's read this essay to pick up on, it's that stop trying to placate him. There are certain voters that will respond to dog whistling that you'll never placate, but test him on the real challenges of a social democratic, socially mobile democratic state and the economics that underpin that.
Yeah, and also that doesn't mean that he's completely ineffective either, because on the issues that he's obsessed with, he can be he can be quite effective and he can cause extreme damage. So I at the same time as I wouldn't underestimate him either. Like he can do damage to the Labor Party, and he already has in some really significant areas for Australian public life.
And he's got a complacent media falling in behind him in a lot of it too. I mean, before I move on to questions, you do say, when he used the phrase that this is a Robin Hood government stealing from the rich to give to the poor on the tax cuts. Well, who was Robin Hood's nemesis? It was the Sheriff of Nottingham who collects taxes for rich people. So let's point that out every time, you know, rather than to the trap.
I can't believe that wasn't the immediate response.
I know. there's a real fear there. I think the ALP and the government need to get some sharpish script writers that can pick up on that stuff.
Well, and just quickly, it goes to that broader thing where I think Labor's been kind of traumatized and demoralized over a long period by elections that they probably should have won.
Yeah.
And so I think there is like a certain belief that that a tax on the top perceived as like the reason for that was because of the tax on the top end of town. So there's a real fear of engaging in class baiting kind of rhetoric. And I understand like the Australia's changed and the kind of like class politics of the 1950s and 60s I don't think that there's that much demand for exactly the same as that, but I think that there still needs to be like a clear articulation of a divide between the top end of town and between the people, not just on the bottom, but also in the middle. Like it's middle, just,
that's right, which is becoming like, hollowed out.
It's not just about the working class. It's also about the middle class. Yeah.
And what we did, you know, as Janet's pointed out, the period of social mobility in Australia was really post-World War II up until the sort of 80s. And then since the 90s, we've been in decline. That was an accident of history for white Australia, obviously. But it wasn't an accident either. It was deliberately developed and forged by government policy. And even throughout the Menzies years, for all that the country was very culturally conservative, Menzies didn't depart that much from the kinds of Keynesian social compact that was put in place after the Second World War. We could continue this all day in furious agreement on most things. But you talked about Robin Hood's nemesis being the Sheriff of Nottingham. So that takes me, it's a nice segue to one of the first questions from our guest, because Roger Tonkin wants me to ask you, who's Dutton's nemesis in Australian politics now that Catherine Murphy's gone to work for the Prime Minister?
I would say his two biggest nemeses, the one from the Labor side is Paul Keating, and the one from the Liberal side now is Malcolm Turnbull. And there's slightly similar reasons, but then quite different reasons. And I think for Keating, Dutton often cites the interest rates in the late 80s, which contributed to the end of his parents' marriage. And I he hasn't said this publicly, I think that a big factor for the contempt that he holds Paul Keating in is the Redfern Address in 92, like not long after Dutton became a police officer, and the way that kind of that played into the heightened attention on the behaviour of police officers and had repercussions for Keating with certain voters. And yeah, I think that that the interest rates and then also the Redfern Address, I think it explained the continued and consistent contempt that he holds Keating in.
Poor Keating can't take a trick these days. The populist rights always hated him. Now the populist left's decided he's the originator of neoliberalism in the world. So I'm sure truth lies somewhere in between. No, I think it's an excellent point. And, you know, both Keating and Turnbull, I think, in their own ways, quite similar in that they were very big vision, good at the rhetoric, sort of forward-looking cosmopolitan type prime ministers, which is the absolute antithesis of what Dutton wants to be and the people he wants to represent, right?
Yeah, I think Dutton has been quite complimentary at times about Bob Hawke,
for example.
I think that and Bob Hawke's a Labor Prime Minister that Liberals will often cite as a way to show that they're not completely partisan, because they'll be like, oh, you know, they're not a patch on Bob Hawke because he was kind of like so it's interesting the way that different.
Interesting too that you've named two men that are now out of politics altogether. And they're the two I would have said as well. But in terms of his current, you know, is there a nemesis for him in the current parliament? I don't think it's Albanese.
It would be
Farmers. He's a Queensland working class economic head. You don't think?
No, it would be Claire. What's that? Sorry. Yeah, Claire O'Neill. Like that's seems to be the person that kind of like generates the most animosity from him, because she's been like kind of taking it to him quite vehemently. So and she's a woman. He's like got a bit of a history of being a bit more heated in his attacks on female political opponents than male ones. So I think it's unsurprising that he seems to be quite offended about, coming under the spotlight.
For all that she's perhaps stretching some of those comments a little much, she's certainly getting under his skin with them. Mm. So I'll give her that for sure. She's a very good operator, Claire. A couple of other questions that I'd like to put to you from the audience. Di Parsons, this is an interesting one. I don't know if you've thought much about this. The essay is very much focused on his history and his position within the domestic political sphere, but Di says she's wondered about his connections with international right-wing politicians, influencers and activists like Bolsonaro, Trump, Farage, Bannon, Do you have any insight on that angle, or do you think it's something that he concerns himself with?
Yeah, look, I think that Dutton certainly fits within the lineage of some of them in terms of some of his behaviour and commentary, but he also predates most of these politicians. Mm. Like he was elected in 2001, and I think that the like and I track it in the essay the way that he became more racially divisive after the election of Trump and after establishment political parties around across the West were starting to grapple with the idea of outsiders. So I think that there is like a connection, there is an influence, and it's part of like global trends. But I don't think it's just that he's woken up one day and is trying to copy those people. He has like history, and I think that in a lot of ways the Liberal Party has kind of exported a lot of political tactics and strategies directly overseas. And so if anything, the Liberal Party has kind of led the pack a little bit, and they've been able to do it while maintaining their position as like the establishment party. And they've been able to absorb the right-wing populist vote. And so there is a connection, but yeah, I think that Dutton wouldn't directly attribute his ideas to any of those leaders. He would see himself in the thrall to John Howard over Donald Trump.
Yeah, and I think you make that case really compellingly in the essay. Janet McCullman wants me to ask you, Lek, what do you think of Dutton weaponising anti-Asian fears, particularly against South Asians, a very big risk in Victoria, New South Wales and increasingly South Australia? And I think that in the context of his identified those outer suburban seats, what Janet's getting at there, I think, is in parts of the country other than Queensland, many of those outer suburban seats are very heavily dominated now by newly arrived communities. Do you think that will backfire in his pursuit?
Yeah, and even in western, southwestern Brisbane is becoming much more ethnically diverse. So northern Brisbane, where Dutton's from and where he holds a seat, is like much more monocultural, much more Anglo and European. So I think it is like but it's not just Dutton. I think the Liberal Party have missed the mark on in so many levels in terms of their engagement with women and with ethnically diverse communities. And because, as I said earlier, like a lot of those seats aren't socially progressive at all. And there's no reason that, and a lot of them are small, lots of small business people, lots of people who are attracted to less government because they might have come from places where there was a much more totalitarian atmosphere. And so I think that they should have been pre-selecting candidates that better reflected modern Australia like a decade ago. And even if they weren't winning seats, they would be getting to the point now where they're ready to win seats, but they haven't done that. And so overnight there, it's going to be hard for them to go to some of those seats in Western Sydney and actually be able to be taken seriously, and because they've just ridden those seats off for so long as unwinnable.
Arguably would have taken Fowler a decade ago if they'd pre-selected Dai Li.
They had the opportunity to pre-select Dai Li in the Senate, and even if she hadn't have had a lower house seat, at least that would have been enormous. Like imagine the signal that would have sent about the modern Liberal Party and having a senator who was based in Fowler, and the way that kind of could have cultivated the kind of electoral support that might have made Labor more vulnerable by now. But they just haven't done it, and if anything, especially on gender, they seem to be getting worse. So I don't know. Yeah, I don't see any massive changes around the corner on that front.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there's a couple more questions before we have to wrap up. One here that goes to what we were talking earlier about the change around talking about class and who appeals to class. Tim Diamond says one of the reasons Labor downplayed talking about class after Whitlam is it needed self-identifying middle-class voters. Labor has been relatively more electorally successful since then compared to the first half of the 20th century. How does reviving class talk by Labor avoid sounding sectional, which was the criticism of pre-Whitlam Labor?
Yeah, I think that, as I said, like I don't think the Labor Party should go back to that rhetoric, and they can't. And so that's a rational thing. And so when I say them talking about class, I don't mean necessarily saying we are the party of the working class. Like they can still identify tangible policy areas and tangible policies that that unite, you know, working class and middle class people together, and that feels like they're identifying the fact that there is like a need to change society, and that there is kind of like a section of society which that does have more power and capital than the rest of society, and that it, like, by identifying that, I don't think that it demonizes middle class people, because I think that to be a viable political party in Australia, you couldn't just be a working class party. You need to appeal to middle class people as well. And I think that that's probably a healthy and good thing for political debates. So yeah, it's not about going right back to the putting the genie back in the bottle, because I don't think that can be done. There isn't the social basis for a working or economic basis for a working class party in Australia anymore. But you can still. Yeah, find those the tangible common ground between voters where they feel like that their primary economic concerns are being addressed.
I think the main thing that people tend to forget or romanticise now about class politics is it was never about keeping people in their class and just pandering to them. Working class politics was about providing the opportunity to become middle class, to establish some security. So to me, it's not something that a Social Democratic Party or a Labor Party should shy away from, to say, actually, our business as a government is to give you an opportunity to build a good life and help you to build a good life, and as far as possible, provide equality of opportunity and mitigate inequality of outcome. That's something most people are on board with, right? So this whole shift at the moment is about, hang on, it's all very well that we all did really well off the mining boom, and there's a generation of wealthy, you know, there's plenty of very, very poor and disadvantaged baby boomers, let me say. But it's great that we did so well, but hang on, we've stuffed a generation here. So if we want to be the country we think we are, we have to restore social mobility. So maybe the term social mobility is more acceptable in that conversation than the class. Last question, and it's from someone anonymous, and I don't know why, because it's a great one, so you should certainly put your name to this, and it's a good question to finish our chat on today. Dutton hasn't really faced a full-on negative advertising campaign as leader, and he's about to head into an election. How do you think he'll cope, given that you describe him in your essay as a hard man with a glass jaw? How do you think he'll cope with what's coming at the next election?
Yeah, it's been interesting because Labor haven't really gone for his jugular yet, and that's been like perplexing at times, but then I think that it's hard to go too early and be gratuitous, and an issue has been that a lot of disengaged voters, or even like relatively engaged voters, don't really know that much about Dutton, and so you can look petty by going too hard too early. You sort of need to let Dutton reveal himself, people to form impressions, so that when you are attacking him, that people have preconceived conceptions about him. And I think that it will be like a really negative campaign. I don't think that Labor's going to have any qualms at all, but I think that they're going to go incredibly hard on the fact that when he was health minister. I think that that's one of those issues where it unites all different classes and kinds of voters. And I think that in terms of some of his nastiness, like the long list of examples of him being nasty to people, it's going to be hard for Labor, because they can't, they agree with a lot of his policies in terms of in different areas. So they can't really disavow themselves from that. But I think it's more about, it will be more about for them trying to create the sense that he is a really hard person, and that if he's so hard to these different disadvantaged groups, like how can you trust this person to be in charge of Medicare, especially if he has form trying to meddle with Medicare and free healthcare? So I think that's, it's going to be interesting to watch how he reacts to that, because, he's been, this is one of the things that also confuses me about conservatives is the way that they don't engage outside of their echo chambers at all, and that's why Dutton's had these really testy exchanges with the ABC, and Howard waged a massive ideological campaign against the ABC for a long period of time. But when he was going on the ABC, he was always able to do it. Like I feel like he didn't seem like a fish out of water. He was able to have a hostile interview, but still impart to the viewers that he was, that he knew what he was talking about and that he was like a statesman style leader. And so that might not necessarily.
Howard used to describe the ABC as our enemies talking to our friends. I think he recognised that in his day, Liberal voters watched the ABC, right? So he had
And it's not just about winning the voters. It's also just about practice. Yep. It's about like the it's about practice so that you're just constantly, you know, practicing, and that then translates to election campaigns. Yep. You're under pressure. It's like being a professional athlete, and at training, you need to train under fatigue so that when you get to the last 5 minutes of a game, that you've trained not just fresh but like under fatigue. And so if you do that, it affects the way that you speak and act towards voters or hostile voters, and so that when you get into that really high pressure situation, you're not going to go to water and you're not going to overreact to something. You're going to be able to remain calm. And so I don't think that they're practicing that muscle at all. And and I think that Labor, you know, get attacked for sometimes engaging too much with the enemy in terms of like hostile conservative media organizations and figures. But in the same way, I like why you shouldn't capitulate to those people. Mm. It is good practice to be able to have conversations and debates with people who might be quite hostile to your worldview.
Yes, and in a country with compulsory voting and a national broadcaster, which is still the only media presence in a lot of regional and rural towns across this country, you cannot win only engaging with one side of politics as you can in America. I think that's an important lesson for everyone. Lick, thank you. Just another fantastic read. If you haven't got the QE yet, why not? And what are you doing here? But there is a link in our chat where you can pick up a copy for $5 off with free shipping, thanks to our friends at Black Ink. Thank you for the work you do. Yours is such an important voice in our politics for the reasons I've said both times we've chatted. But I think your clear-eyed analysis, your ability to bring your lived experience into your work without it being in any way self-reflective or narcissistic, and just your real clarity of thought on how Australians think without pandering or sneering at any point is really incredibly valuable. You're one of the best young voices in our public debate. So thank you for making time.
I really appreciate it. I really appreciate your deep engagement and the platform provided by these conversations. And it's amazing to come out of the solitude of writing something like that and be able to engage with people and, you know, be able to share ideas and thoughts and insights. So it's amazing. I really appreciate it.
Well, we value it very much. Thank you. And thank you all for joining us. This recording will be up soon on our website. Next week we have our monthly John Cain lunch, which will be hybrid in person in Melbourne and online. And we're talking to Paul Tilley about his book, The History of Tax Reform in Australia, which many people would go, why? But I know this audience is going to find it just as thrilling as I will talking about tax reform. There is a history of tax reform in this country. Many young people won't remember it. Stage 3 tax cuts was not tax reform. We'll get to that next week. Please, thank you again, Lex. Thank you all for joining us, and please do join us at our next event at Per Capita.
Bye-bye. Awesome. Thanks a lot. Catch you later.